Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Anxiously entering the third year of the pandemic and facing other huge challenges, inequality, injustice, endangered democracy, climate change, we need to take care of ourselves. Here's my 2013 conversation with Rick Hansen about his book, Hardwiring Happiness, where he brings together mindfulness and the latest neuroscience to offer proactive practices to actually shift your brain's neural structure, the hardwiring, toward calm, contentment, and confidence. Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum. This is a holiday show, and so my wish for all of you, may this season bring you many moments of peace, love, warmth, reflection, connection, laughter, infectious joy. And may we all enjoy a just and happy 2014, and as a society, may we begin to share better the gifts and the responsibilities that we have as human beings and as citizens. My guest today is Rick Hansen, neuropsychologist and author of the bestseller Buddha's Brain, and we're going to talk about his latest book, Hardwiring Happiness, where he brings together mindfulness and neuroscience and offers proactive practices that you can do to actually shift the brain's neural structure, the hardwiring, toward calm, contentment, and confidence. So stick around. This time of year can be challenging for people. Holidays bring us in contact with family, which for many carries a charge. We're all asked to be more social than usual. There are those office parties, those get-togethers, the round-the-dinner-table conversations. We need a story to tell. And it also feels natural, I think, to take stock and self-assess at the end and the beginning of a calendar year, and some of us can be pretty hard on ourselves. Well, Rick Hansen and I are going to talk about how you can use some new lessons that science is learning about the brain to overcome its so far evolutionarily successful negativity bias, the brain's tendency to hardwire negative and threatening experiences more easily and more quickly than positive ones. It's important that you avoid predators. It's worked for millennia, and the ones who didn't had fewer children, less of them around. So before we get into that, let me offer a personal story. September 11th, 2001, I had a morning meeting that would last about 3 hours. Yes, that's September 11th. I had a morning meeting that would last about 3 hours, after which I was going to hit the road for the 4-hour drive to a small cabin on a small lake a few miles from the entrance to Sequoia National Park. I hadn't read or heard any news that morning. Somehow I'd avoided my computer until I arrived at a monthly get-together of a handful of folks involved with the nonprofit world. We'd been meeting together for about 8 years, so we were pretty close. Well, by the time that door opened, the second tower had been hit. I spent the rest of that day with friends, focused on the attack. But the next morning, I drove up to that cabin. No TV, no internet connection, no smartphones. And I would go into the small nearby town each day for an LA Times and to check email. But I did not have the experience of 9/11 that is the common experience that everyone assumes we shared. I didn't see those horrific images over and over again. I didn't focus on the events or the responses for those first few days. I spent time writing and watching the vultures in the tree across the lake. On Saturday, I drove into the park. Once inside, it's about a 45-minute drive through some spectacular peaks and forests to the headquarters and the trailhead for the 10-mile loop that I was going to hike, back when my knees welcomed such things. I'd walked about halfway that day, and I was ready for a break when I came upon a huge boulder. I climbed up to a comfortable perch, pulled off my backpack, and ate my lunch. Now, I had brought with me a book of poetry, The Essential Rumi, translated by Coleman Barks, and I determined to open the book to one poem and to read that one poem as the message for the day or for those times. And I opened to a poem entitled Father Reason, and I was not thrilled. I'd been anticipating something more celebratory in that joyous way that Rumi expresses love of life. Well, the title Father Reason did not sound like such a poem to me, but a deal's a deal. And this is the poem that I read on that rock 3,000 miles southwest of Ground Zero. Father Reason by Rumi. The universe is a form of divine law. Your reasonable father. When you feel ungrateful to him, the shapes of the world seem mean and ugly. Make peace with that father, the elegant patterning, and every experience fills with immediacy. Because I love this, I am never bored. Beauty constantly wells up, a sound of spring water in my ear and in my inner being. Tree limbs rise and fall like the ecstatic arms of those who have submitted to the mystical life. Leaf sounds talk together like poets, making fresh metaphors. The green felt cover slips, and we get a flash of the mirror underneath. Think what the world will be when the whole thing is pulled away. I tell only 1/1000th of what I see, because there's so much doubt everywhere. The conventional opinion of this poetry, it is optimistic about the future. Father Reason says, no need to announce the future. This now is it. Your deepest need and desire is satisfied by the moment's energy here in your hand. Now, I memorized that poem by reading it over and over as I continued to hike the remaining 5 miles, and I came upon a stream, naturally, just as I read A Sound of Spring Water in My Ear. I can think of no other poem or piece of scripture or words of wisdom that better expresses what I experience to be the truth about life and existence. Make peace with that, Father, the elegant patterning in every experience fills with immediacy. Because I love this moment, this whatever this is, I am never bored. This now is it, your deepest need and desire satisfied by the moment's energy here in your hand. So can we do anything to improve our chances of experiencing that immediacy, that love of the moment that can never be bored? That's what I'm going to talk about with Rick Hansen. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Rick Hansen, Ph.D., is a neuropsychologist, a founder of the Wellspring Institute for Neuroscience and Contemplative Wisdom. He's on the advisory board of the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley. He's been an invited speaker at Oxford, Stanford, Harvard, taught in meditation centers worldwide. His books include Buddha's Brain, Just One Thing, and his latest, Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. Welcome again, Rick Hansen, to Free Forum.
Terrence, it's truly an honor to be here. I'm so happy to talk with you about all this.
Yeah. And it's, as I said, this is a time when I think people can use a gift like this.
Yes, definitely. What a touching story as well that you told there.
Thank you. I mean, it really was what, you know, I looked at that book and I went, oh, no. And then as I read that poem and that line, when you feel ungrateful to the universe, the shapes of the world seem mean and ugly, I immediately flashed to the scenes that I had seen of Ground Zero. And make peace with that, Father, and every experience fills with immediacy, and I'm in, you know, the forest of the Sequoia and so on. And it has stuck with me tremendously. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So I want you, in your own words, to tell us a bit about your path to the work that you do today. You can mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. Now, I said in the intro that your work brings together mindfulness and neuroscience. You also have a clinical practice and your own personal journey. So take your time and tell us how those several strands have woven together in your life and career. What questions have driven you and how the answer to one question might lead you in another direction along the way?
Well, it's a deep question.
I know.
there we go. Well, two parts here. So first part, I think like a lot of people, as a young child, I had this background sense that there was a lot of unnecessary happiness. I couldn't conceptualize it. You know, I was literally, it's kind of implicit in my earliest memories going back to about 3 years old. But again, I think like a lot of people who talk about this or who can surface the fact that in the wallpaper, if you will, in the background of their earliest memories, was a sense of needless hassling, criticizing, struggling, arguing, yuck, worry, and so forth. And so I longed for the kind of happiness that I felt was possible in a world, as you put it, that just might work. So that was the beginning for me of my kind of journey. And then overlapping that, as I grew up, I had a very late birthday, and I also skipped a grade. So like a lot of people of my generation, I was quite young going through school. I was actually very young. And nothing terrible happened to me, but I did have many, many experiences of feeling and being excluded, put down, dismissed, mild bullying, you know.
Let me also just share with you, Rick, I also skipped a grade and can absolutely relate to that. On the one hand, the system thinks they're doing you a favor, but those experiences of being younger and less experienced are something I don't think they're quite taken into account.
Yeah, that's right. They don't usually do it these days. So it was well-intended, but that said, actions have consequences, right? Causes have effects. So I grew up at the point that I entered college, you know, at 16, with what felt like a quote-unquote hole in my heart, a sense of an emptiness inside where normally, in terms of healthy development, psychological development, there would have been a much more of an internalized sense of worth and being included and also comfortable with other people. So fast forward then to, you know, my college days, and I stumbled on this kind of amazing thing that still seems amazing to me today, which is that I found that if I, number one, noticed good facts related to my issues, the key resource experiences, as it were, the antidote experiences that I needed, if I noticed good facts that were relevant to me, such as being included by a group of guys who said, "Hey, Hanson, let's go get some pizza," or some girl would smile at me in the elevator, or maybe a teacher would invite me to, you know, join something he was doing, what have you. You know, when that happened, number one, I needed to notice it. Number two, I needed to actually feel something as a result, not just stay in my head about it, which is, you know, where I'd come to live. And also third, most important of all, which is what my, you know, recent interests really focus on, I needed to take in the good. I needed to stay with that experience 10, 20 seconds in a row, maybe even longer, to feel like it was really sinking into me, and sometimes even connecting with those younger layers inside me that had been mistreated and longed to be included and valued. Any single time I did that did not change everything for me, but bit by bit, drop by drop, honestly, I really did feel that I was gradually filling that hole in my heart. And, you know, then fast forward 20, 30 years later, as a psychologist and a neuropsychologist, I've come to understand more what I was doing, and I'm sure we'll talk about it. The other thing that happened for me, and you and I, as listeners should know, do share some history. You know, we knew each other, I think, even 30 years ago.
Yeah, I think the mid-70s, yeah.
Yeah, the human potential movement and so forth, the wild and woolly west, if you will.
Yep.
So that was a phenomenally important influence on me, just the sense of what was truly possible in terms of human potential and self-actualization. And also at that time, I stumbled upon contemplative practice, mostly in its Eastern manifestations, Buddhism and Hinduism, but also with some sense of it as it shows up in other traditions in the world, like Christianity, Islam, or Judaism, or secular traditions even of mindfulness today. So I started meditating in 1974, and that too, even though I was doing it in, you know, like a beginner's kind of way with my long hair and gold-rimmed glasses and wood flute, and that I was very cool and all that, still, it suddenly gave me a window in a new way into the depths of my own mind and into, if you will, the nature of experience as experience, just in terms of, like, phenomenologically, what it's actually like. And so since then, I've had a growing interest in, if you will, the intersection of three circles, one being psychology. You know, I got a PhD in clinical psychology by way of a lot of training in developmental psychology. Second circle being brain science, neuroscience. Because if we understand more of the causes inside the black box, you know, the 3 pounds of tofu-like tissue between our ears, if we understand more of the causes of what's going on there, we're then going to become more and more able to influence those causes for our own sake and for the sake of the wider world. And then also the third circle being contemplative wisdom. So if you think of the intersection of those three circles, especially in my own case, I think of myself as a methods guy, I'm very interested in applications, because that's where I think you really test things out, and that's also near and dear to my own interests and service. So I've gotten very interested in applying what can be found there at the center of those three circles, psychology, neuroscience, and contemplative wisdom. So I guess that's kind of an overview.
Yeah. So
along the way, got married, had a couple kids, young adults, did some business consulting, and here we are today.
Very good. Let me tell people, this is Freeform. I'm Terrence McNally speaking with Rick Hanson, neuropsychologist, editor of the Wise Brain Bulletin, author of the bestseller Buddha's Brain, and we're going to talk primarily today about his newest bestseller, Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And you can learn more at rickhanson.net. So that's .net, and it's Hanson, H-O-H-A-N-S-O-N, Rick Hanson, H-A-N-S-O-N.net. Okay, so you began the sort of unschooled practice of noticing and of savoring moments of the good while in college. You added to that mindfulness or meditation practice in the mid-70s. What's that, grad school and a little beyond. And did you know at what point did you know you were going to develop a clinical practice?
Well, I always wanted to work with people. And in fact, one reason why I kind of tilted toward the human potential movement at UCLA from 1969 to 1974, when I was an undergrad there, was because mainstream psychology honestly seemed, you know, about running rats through mazes and stuff like that. And also, you know, the human potential folks had better parties, so that's, you know, cooler, you know.
Yep. You know, I was a little earlier than that at Harvard, and there was one building, the William James Building, that housed psychology and social relations. I was in social relations, and when the elevator would stop at certain floors, which were the, you know, not the clinical, but the psychology, the serious research, you know, everyone would go, oh, rats and pigeons, you know, and then they'd go on to the next floor where it was, you know, people again.
Yeah, exactly right. So, you know, that was, I knew I just wanted to work with people. My early experience, you know, just helping people in my dorm and, you know, being a telephone counselor and stuff like that. My dad's a professor, and I have tremendous interest in science. He's a retired zoologist.
My next question was going to be, when did you add the thread of neuroscience?
Mm-hmm. That's great. So I've always had I'm a geek, you know. I've always had a real interest in science and the facts. It struck me as an orderly universe, in contrast to, you know, the neighborhoods I grew up in, the schools I went to, and so forth, which were much more emotionally disordered and really confusing to a young kid. So I've always liked that about science, and I have a feeling for it. But at the end of the day, my own personal interest, as someone who consumes a ton of science and respects bench scientists, I'm really interested in, as it were, essentializing the key takeaways from the research, integrating it with other research, and then in particular applying it. So I kind of made some mistakes in my early 20s, like a lot of people I think do. In the early 20s, I didn't bet on myself in some ways, and I underestimated the power of investing in your own career when you're young and your own training, because the cost of that investment in grad school or business apprenticeships or other kinds of development, the cost of that get amortized over the 40, 50 years of your career while the benefits accumulate exponentially. But easily, I think by my late 20s, it was clear to me that I really wanted to become a therapist and that I needed to get some legitimate credentialing in that regard. And that's pretty much what, and I'm 61 today, so that's what pretty much set me on my path.
Well, let me ask about the one other thread that you've added, which is writing.
Oh, yeah.
When did you say, I'm going to write? When did you begin to feel like a writer? And how does your writing intersect with all those other areas?
Great question. I think of writing, and people write in different ways. You know, in part, for me, writing comes out of teaching. In that I like teaching, and I come from a family of teachers, my father, my grandmother, my sister, aunt, and so forth, families of teachers on, you know. And the other thing is that when you teach, you generate text, especially if you teach these days with PowerPoints and whatnot. So that's part of it. The other part of it is that writing is a fantastic way to leverage your contributions. I mean, if you're talking one-to-one or in a workshop, because I've led a lot of workshops as well, you know, maybe you'll reach one person at a time or even 100 or 200 people at a time. But what you're doing right now, for example, is reaching thousands, maybe even tens or if not hundreds of thousands of people. And if someone can write something that goes out Buddha's brain, for example, is in, I think, 25 or 26 languages. You really can reach around the world. And I'm, honestly, Terrence, extremely heartened by emails I get where people say, wow, this made a difference to me, you know? So I don't consider myself a great writer, but I do think I've tried to become a good writer and do the best that I can in that regard.
And in some ways, a translator, right? Because since what we've been talking about is how we're going to bring contemplation, meditation, neuroscience, and all of these together, when you're writing, your role really is a synthesizer and a translator.
That's right. And a really important piece of advice I got along the way, and I'll offer this to anybody, including people who want to write, is to really hold in your awareness, especially if you do the kind of, you know, more nonfiction, self-help kind of writing I do. But I think it's a broad point. Keep in mind the real being who's going to be reading your words and feel into your relationship with that person. So I literally imagine people who are, and kinds of people who are reading my work, and I want to make sure I continue to be relevant to them, especially these days when, you know, if there's normal temperamental variation in the hunter-gatherer bands we're involved in, if you will, you know, anxious, rigid, you know, turtles at one end and spirited ADHD-ish jackrabbits at the other. We live in a jackrabbity culture, so people have shorter and shorter attention spans, and they're also being bombarded with very seductive appeals for attention in other directions. So if, as a writer, you're going to sustain someone's attention over, you know, a page of text or 300 pages of text, you need to keep thinking about how am I entertaining this person, how am I inspiring this person, and in my domain especially, how am I offering value to this person. But if you do that, you know, you're gonna just do a lot better.
Very good. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Rick Hansen. He's the author of Buddha's Brain and a new book, which is also a bestseller, Hardwiring Happiness, The New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And you can learn more at rickhanson.net. That's rickhanson.net. Okay. I want to go back to, again, we're talking about how life and work come together, but children and family have played a big role in your life and career. And you actually co-wrote with your wife, Jan, and an OBGYN, Mother Nurture. What is the big message of that book?
Yeah, that, speaking of 9/11, that book came out soon after 9/11. And, you know, the national conversation was not particularly about taking good care of families at that point. There were other front burner issues. But what that book's about is, it's really, I think, still the only book that comprehensively looks at the long-term health and well-being and intimate relationships of a woman raising children past the postpartum period, where there's a lot of attention. And it's very practical, so it zeroes in on health in terms of mind, body, and intimate relationships. And part of what drove it for me was watching my own wife, who's a very sturdy person, physically and mentally, become very depleted after our kids came along. And, you know, if you think about a world that just might work for everyone, the place to start, one extremely highly leveraged intervention, obviously, is to make the welfare of mothers, if you will, the defining or, you know, certainly top five public health priority. I mean, for a whole generation, that would transform the world because we'd then be raising a whole new generation of children. But to do that, you've got to really take good care of the mother. So my book's about that vision down in the trenches. How do you actually do it? And it's quite striking when you take a look at the research on this, Terrence. You know, we're two guys talking about it. And, you know, what's the one factor that for women increases risk, research shows this, risks of depression, autoimmune illnesses, certain kinds of cancer, certain kinds of cardiovascular issues, depression, anxiety, and several other things. What's the one risk? It's the number of children she has.
Wow.
0 to 1 to 2 to 3. And I have to say this, that I think that if men had similar issues, you know, like hypothetically, what's the one thing that increases a man's risk of cardiovascular disease, certain cancers, depression, autoimmune illnesses, is having sex? Oh my God, you know, the guys would be all over that and we'd have incredible amounts of funding for it. So, you know, the dirty little secret of motherhood is that it's both profoundly meaningful, and for most women, they'll report, it's the most demanding and draining thing they've ever done, and it actually has consequences eventually. You know, I'm not speaking against having children, obviously, nor blaming the children. I'm saying realistically, if we want to in a causal universe. We want to enable women to be able to sustain a very responsive and therefore demanding style of parenting. That's the best thing for children. Boy, oh boy, oh boy, we need to really keep filling up their cup so they don't start running on empty.
Very good. And is that book still available?
Yeah, it's available on Kindle and other digital platforms. It's gone out of print, but you can still find it in print. But it's mostly available electronically, I think. It's quite inexpensive. And, you know, I have a lot of fondness. I wrote that book with my wife, who's a clinical nutritionist, as well as we have a third author who's an OBGYN. And it's well-referenced, super solid, published by Penguin. A very good book, I think.
Okay, Mother Nurture. What are the big ideas between your books, Buddha's Brain and Just One Thing? And I'll lump them together and people understand why in a second.
I think the short version is that, I guess shared with even my most recent one, that you really can use your mind to change your brain, to change your mind for the better, benefiting you and, you know, in widening ripples out to the whole world. So Buddha's Brain is kind of a survey of the neuroscience of what's called self-directed neuroplasticity, the idea that in specific targeted ways you can stimulate the neural circuits or the neural factors that underlie wholesome, positive, powerful states of mind, states of mind or factors like loving kindness or resilience or happiness. So because in the famous saying from the work of the Canadian psychologist Donald Hebb, neurons that fire together wire together. So if you stimulate the neural substrates, the neural circuits or other factors of powerful, useful, beneficial, wholesome states of mind, if you stimulate those substrates, you will strengthen them. So that's what Buddha's Brain is about, including in bringing in insights from the contemplative traditions. I teach meditation and think of myself, and when I wear certain hats as a Buddhist teacher, you know, the people who have been the contemplatives in the world's tradition and traditions, and the one I know best is Buddhism, are sometimes called the Olympic athletes of mental training. They're the ones who have really developed the ability to have unconditional happiness and sturdiness and determination and love, even in the face of great difficulty. And if you want to get good at anything, right? If I want to get good at interviewing, I'm going to listen to Terrence McNally for that and other purposes. You know, if you want to get good at something, study the people who've made it their life's work, right? If you want to get good at tennis, watch Roger Federer or Martina Navratilova, or I'm dating myself, or a more recent woman, you know, tennis player. You know, not some, you know, inept person, you know, in your neighborhood court. So anyway, so in the same way, by studying the people who've really trained their minds and by understanding more what's going on in their brains, we can then do some reverse engineering. And that's what Buddha's Brain is a lot about, imagining what could be going on in the brain of a Buddha or in other traditions, anyone who's fully awakened, or for the rest of us, me included, people who are, you know, working their own personal path of awakening, personal growth and healing, whatever that might be. And if we can reverse engineer based on some understanding of what's going on in the brains of people as they progress down the path, including far down the path, well, then we can use that those insights to activate the mental states and therefore strengthen their neural substrates, gradually changing our brain for the better.
Okay, so I just want people to, Rick, I want people to make sure that they get what you're saying, is that we used to, I think it was conventional wisdom, I don't know if it was science, but I think it was conventional wisdom for a long time that the brain is basically formed maybe by youth or adolescence. And we used to hear more about losing brain cells and brain cells dying and so on. And it was kind of, that was the story. And it turns out science has found that's not true, leading to that possibility that you're describing, that in fact we can play a role not just in changing how we think, but in how our brain actually is formed and functions.
Yes, thank you for slowing me down there. See, I'm studying the master interviewer. There you go. Anyway, that's what scientists call experience-dependent neuroplasticity. It's the idea that the brain is the organ that learns. And in order to learn, it must change in some way in its structure or function. In other words, whether it's a child learning to walk instead of crawl or an adult learning how to navigate a tricky conversation with a partner, say, in any case, in either of those cases, and in all other cases in which there's learning, like the multiplication tables, or more fundamentally, growing, you know, growing through healing, or growing to become more, you know, resilient in everyday life, or to have more happiness inside, or to have more love for other people, any kind of growth must involve changing in the brain. So that's not the breaking news, as you point out. What is the breaking news is the radical new insights in the past couple decades or so, especially the last 10 years, about the depth and breadth of those changes in neural structure and function, and the growing capabilities of people to use that science in very practical ways, which is my particular interest.
Very
good.
People
should not underestimate the capacity of their mind to change the brain one way or the other, and as we'll probably get into, unfortunately, to help our ancestors survive, as you said at the beginning of this interview, the brain is vulnerable to changing for the worse from our experiences. In other words, in a nutshell, it's very good at learning from bad experiences, but it's comparatively bad at learning from good experiences, even though learning from good experiences is the primary way to grow inner strengths inside, including the strengths of happiness or positive mood.
Yeah.
Back to your point about, you know, 9/11, studies show that people who had cultivated kind of an underlying baseline, if you will, of well-being and positive emotion prior to 9/11 were more able to handle the stresses of 9/11, including people that were impacted very directly by it.
Very good. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That's Rick Hansen. He's a neuropsychologist, has a clinical practice, editor of the Wise Brain Bulletin, and author of the bestseller, Buddha's Brain, and his newest, also a bestseller, Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And you can learn more about all of that. And he has it's a pretty robust website with access to practices and articles and audio and all of that sort of thing at rickhanson.net. That's RickHanson, rickhanson.net. This is Free Forum on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 in Santa Barbara, streaming and podcasting at kpfk.org. And for this week's conversation and many other interviews and articles, you can, and also to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can also get a feel for my work with strategic communications with nonprofits and foundations and maybe your organization at terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and four or five articles of background on those issues, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. Check out Freeform with Terrence McNally on Facebook, and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Okay, so we're about halfway through, Rick, and what we've laid out is the foundation for hardwiring happiness, correct?
Right.
Okay, so that neuroplasticity, that ability to come in to actually change things, and that negativity bias, your new book is really up against how do we confront, how do we deal with the negativity bias? Talk a bit about that.
Okay, great. Well, let's see. So let's start with the good news. We all want to have good stuff inside. In other words, we all want to have, let's say, more strength of heart, more self-confidence, more feeling worthy, more sense of being attractive to others, let's say, more sense of being a good person. We want to have more happiness. We want to have more compassion. We want to be more mindful, whatever it is, including subtle spiritual insights new ways of looking at our own childhood. You know, it's funny, mid-20s, you know, speaking of my 20s, I had the insight, I realized that growing up, I had been a nerd, not a wimp. Now, that's a really good insight, especially for a guy. And I wanted to really help that idea sink in. Okay, so we want to grow the good stuff inside. How do we get the good stuff inside, right? Because obviously the good stuff inside is made out of brain structure. How do we get the good stuff in our brain? How do we grow positive traits? All right. Well, positive traits are grown from positive states. the neuropsychology of learning is a two-stage process. Learning equals brain change, including emotional learning, what's called learning in implicit memory, not learning of specific facts or acquiring personal recollections. That's called explicit memory, but more learning how to do things or shifting our attitudes or expectations in various positive directions and so forth. It's shaping the inner atmosphere of the mind, what it feels like to be me altogether. Okay, that process of learning happens in two stages in which states, momentary thoughts, feelings, hopes, dreams, sorrows, body sensations, and all the rest of that, momentary states are activated, and then they must be installed in neural structure for there to be any lasting benefit. Otherwise, that momentary mental state washes through the brain like water over a driveway. Okay. The bad news, first the good news. So positive traits are built from positive states that are installed in the brain. All right.
Okay. Let me get over that again. So something happens. We have an experience. Mm-hmm. Most of those, as you say, will flow away. Will disappear. Will have moved on. And they don't. They change our experience for that moment, but they don't actually change the structure of the brain. But some do.
That's
and
correct.
What we're going to talk about is why some do.
Exactly right. So the bad news is that negative mental states encode immediately in neural structure. They have an advantage in terms of turning into neural structure. This is the brain's negativity bias, in which, in order to evolve, our ancestors had to both, get carrots and avoid sticks, as it were. They had to get carrots like food and mating opportunities. That's not a phrase I use with my wife, by the way. But anyway, and they had to avoid sticks like predators, natural hazards, aggression, and so forth. Okay. The difference, though, is between carrots and sticks, is that if you fail to get a carrot today, like food or a mating opportunity, you'll probably have a chance tomorrow to get one. But if you fail to avoid that predator today, or that aggression inside your band or between bands, right, that stick, in other words, whack, you probably get no more carrots forever. So the brain has developed this negativity bias in which it preferentially scans for bad news. Second, when it finds it, it zeroes in upon it and kind of ignores the whole, context altogether. Third, the brain overreacts to bad news compared to good news. For example, if you play two sounds for people in a study, and they're equally loud, but one sound is pleasant, like the ringing of a bell, the other is unpleasant, like a fire alarm, the brain will react more to that negative sound. And then in particular, for my purposes, that whole package, negative stimulus and overreactive negative response, whoop, is fast-tracked into storage. Once burned, twice shy.
So we're more on the alert for negative information, negative events, negative messages. So we pick them up quicker, we pick them up more strongly, and the trickiest thing, which you just said, is we more quickly turn them into neural structure.
That's right. Think of a relationship, let's say, if someone at home or at work, what have you. Let's say 10 things happen in a day, 5 are positive, 4 are neutral, and 1 is negative. What's the one you think about just before falling asleep? It's usually the negative one. Let's say you get a performance review or you're just talking with your boss and your boss gives you, 10 pieces or 20 pieces of feedback. 19 are positive, and 1 is the room for improvement one.
Right. Okay. The one that I get is I give speeches sometimes, and, of course, you pass out evaluation forms.
Yep.
And you can have, just the room loves you, but those 5, those 10, those 12 that have some nit to pick, they're the ones that stick.
Yeah, exactly right. And in a more formal way, studies show that, for example, we remember negative information about other people more than positive information, thus attack ads in politics. We also learn faster. Animals and humans and other animals learn faster, unfortunately, from pain than from pleasure. Pain is very motivating to avoid. Also in couples, research shows that couples that stay strong and over a long period of time need at least a 5-to-1 ratio of positive to negative interactions, because that one negative interaction has much more effect in memory than those positive interactions.
So what we're dealing with at this point is kind of a quirk of evolution, if you will. In other words, this negativity bias has been a foundational successful survival strategy. Those humans who didn't have that that survival strategy or were weaker in it or overrode it may not be their children may not be here now. So this shift that we're trying to make, it seems to me, I was reading this stuff, I remembered a book by Ehrlich and Ornstein, New World, New Mind. Do you know this book?
No.
Oh, it came out in 2000. Robert Ornstein, Paul Ehrlich. The subtitle is Moving Toward Conscious Evolution, and it made the point that we do not have time to evolve biologically.
Okay.
To deal with the new circumstances we find ourselves in, whether that's climate change or, you know, tribes of a million in a city and all of these sorts of things. And could you talk a bit about that? And would you call your practices tools for conscious evolution, which is what they said we've got to do? We can't wait for biology. It takes too long for things to change unless we consciously take control of that evolution.
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? Well, obviously, these are great authorities and scholars, and of course, biological evolution proceeds much more slowly than social or cultural or mental evolution. And let's also not forget that even as recently, gosh, as the 20th century, I've been reading some novels about Europe around the beginning of World War II, and it's haunting to appreciate how useful it's been for many, many people to survive and pass on their genes, which is fundamentally the engine of biological evolution. How useful it's been for people even today, let alone during hunter-gatherer times or let alone over the 600 million years that the nervous system has been evolving. It's been really adaptive to acquire a negativity bias. The problem is that for the Stone Age brain now in the 21st century, it's driving global warming and it's leading to lots and lots of intergroup conflict. And down now at the scale I tend to work, which is the individual level, it's creating a lot of needless suffering for people, and it's taking years off people's lives, because when you're stressed due to the negativity bias, you know, that wears on your body and mind, and it also creates a lot of needless interpersonal conflict. That's why what interests me a lot is working with this Stone Age brain that has some wonderful capabilities, but it needs some help. In other words, most positive mental states, as you pointed out, wash through the brain, you know, like water through a sieve, while negative ones get caught routinely. And that's the fundamental bottleneck in the brain. That is the dirty little secret in psychotherapy, mindfulness training, coaching, human resources training, character education, and whatnot. Most of the positive mental states that we have ourselves or that we help others have make no difference at all. They're momentarily pleasant, better than a stick in the eye, but they have no lasting value if they don't change the structure in the brain.
Now, it seems to me that that finding has to, I mean, it sounds like it would have to revolutionize therapy. And if you think that, okay, we're, you know, this is how we've been doing it, but suddenly you have this new information that says if you, that's not going to stick. I remember when I saw you speak, I thought that's why I think certain cathartic weekend workshops and so on have a power. Anyone who's done these sorts of things has a power that the same number of hours of weekly therapy might not. Am I onto something there?
I think you are in general terms. In other words, psychotherapy actually is a very robust intervention. If a pharmaceutical company could patent it based on the research that shows that it stacks up very well against, for example, meds for many, many mental conditions. In fact, it's better than meds in many, many cases on average. I'm not speaking against meds. Often a combined approach is best for certain issues. But all that said, no, I think psychotherapy is impressive. On the other hand, I'll say this too, it's also true that many therapies intuitively work the installation phase of learning. In other words, they help people implicitly do what I make explicit in my book in the heal process.
Without necessarily knowing why they were doing it, or that the science behind it.
They knew it intuitively, or they had a felt sense. I knew it. I had an intuition in my college years, and then thereafter, that if I stayed with the experience, it just made sense that I was going to learn from it better in terms of emotional learning. And also, there are many therapists who are naturally gifted in this department. That said, you're right. I think that one of the things that's really interesting and true is that, I say this as a mindfulness teacher and also a longtime psychotherapist, we tend to be very good at activating positive mental states in our clients, our students, our children, even in ourselves. But we're not typically very good at installing them in lasting neural structure. And that's where I think most of the opportunity is these days in terms of mental health broadly, personal growth, transformation, healing, psychotherapy, et cetera. I think the opportunity where there's upside potential is in the installation phase of learning. And as an interesting finding, Terrence, if you take a look at outcome studies on psychotherapy, let's say, over the last 30 years, and you take the average response to treatment 30 years ago compared to today, well, people on average respond no better today to a round of psychotherapy than they did 30 years ago, even though in the last 30 years there's been a lot of development in the field in terms of new ideas, new theories, new techniques, new personalities, and all the rest of that. And I think it's because, on average, we've gotten better at activating various mental states, but we've gotten no better at installing them in the brain.
Okay. This is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That's Rick Hansen. We're talking about his new bestseller, Hardwiring Happiness, the new brain science of contentment, calm, and confidence. And you can learn more at rickhanson.net. That's Hansen, H-A-N-S-O-N. This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2013 conversation with Rick Hansen about his book, Hardwiring Happiness, the new brain science of contentment, calm, and confidence. So, what are those factors that might help a brain install neuropathways of good experiences? What are those things that seem to overcome this tendency to have them fly away?
That's great. I summarize them using the acronym HEAL, H-E-A-L, and I'll take you through it quickly here. H stands for have a positive experience in the first place. In other words, this acronym takes you through the well-established two-stage process of learning in research on neuropsychology of learning, activation to installation. And by the way, I should add that as you move from an activated positive state, mental state of thought, of feeling, a sensation in the body, as you move from activated positive mental state to installed positive neural trait, then that positive neural trait fosters more positive mental states, which then you can reinstall to reinforce that nice, you know, inner strength you've been acquiring, that positive neural trait you've been developing. Okay, so in terms of the HEAL acronym, in the first step, you have a positive experience, usually because you notice one you're already having, or you deliberately create one. And when I say a positive experience, I'm talking about the ordinary experiences of daily life. On the 0 to 10 intensity scale, these are the ones and the twos. You know, you finish a tricky email, and there's an opportunity for a moment of satisfaction or accomplishment. You have a nice little conversation with a friend, or the guys in the deli are friendly toward you. There's an opportunity there to feel cared about or befriended in some way. You get a sense of some inner strength or vitality after finishing a Pilates workout or going for a run. That, too, is an opportunity for a positive experience. Or maybe you just look outside and it's beautiful. Ain't dead yet, you know?
Yeah.
Coffee smells good. Glazed donuts taste good. Don't tell my nutritionist wife. But anyway, so now you got this positive experience. Or maybe you think of things that make you feel grateful, or you call to mind someone who cares about you, or you deliberately activate a sense of compassion.
So let me just point out for people what you're saying there is that when a good experience happens, when it comes along, then there's ways to savor it and make it more likely. But there also, you can, as you were just pointing out, you can actually generate positive experiences, positive memories. You can make yourself shift your attention from the negative to the positive, and then work the process.
That's exactly right, and it's important to be clear that I'm not talking about positive thinking or looking on the bright side, et cetera. I'm talking really about realistic thinking, being aware, in spite of the negativity bias, of the positive facts in your life, and then helping those positive facts become a positive experience as appropriate. And then, in particular, once you got that positive experience running, you got that good mental state going, that good thought, that good emotion, that useful intention, that new insight that you were a nerd but not a wimp, whatever it is, you know, then you move into the installation phase. And that's where the rest of the acronym comes in, of HEAL. E for enrich. there are five very well-known factors in the neuropsychology of learning, including emotional learning and personal development, that will really heighten the encoding of a passing mental state into some kind of lasting neural structure that will have enduring value for you. And those five factors that enrich the experience are duration. Try to stay with it for a dozen seconds or more. Give it time. Give the experience time to transfer out of short-term memory buffers down into long-term storage. Another factor is intensity. The more intensely those neurons are firing together, the more intensely they're going to be wiring together. Third factor, multimodality. You can enrich the experience by trying to feel it in your body, opening to it emotionally, maybe enact it in some way, you know, sit up a little straighter to strengthen a feeling of determination, or maybe put your hand on your heart to strengthen a feeling of compassion. And then the fourth factor that enriches the experience, turning it into neural structure, is novelty. The brain is a big novelty detector. It's constantly searching for the new. So, you know, try to see what might be fresh. Look at your experiences, as the poet puts it, through the eyes of a child. Or in Zen, as they say, beginner's mind, Zen mind. All right. And then finally, personal relevance. That will enrich the experience, too. How could it help me? Now, you don't have to do all of these. Any one of them is good. Typically, what people do is they sustain the duration of the experience, a dozen or two dozen seconds or more, while trying to feel it in their body, and that will make a big difference.
So I know I do this, I make you repeat yourself, but sometimes I think a list like that, it helps to, you know, there people are listening as it goes through, but it's it's five factors?
Yeah, that help enrich.
Novelty is one.
Yeah, so I'll start in order. Duration.
Yeah. Okay. So if you so something longer. That lasts longer has a better chance of turning into neural structure. So you choose to extend your experience. You stay with it. You don't allow yourself to shift to the next thing until you've actually savored it and taken it in.
That's exactly right. And it becomes interesting for many people to recognize how hard it is for them to simply enjoy an ordinary, wholesome experience for a dozen seconds in a row.
Okay.
All kinds of things come up. You know, the jackrabbity, temperamental tendencies, distractibility, or they feel somehow vulnerable to bring attention inward and to really enjoy something positive, or they feel they don't deserve it, or it's not right for them to do this, and so forth. Or their job, as many people feel, including, you know, statistically, it's common among women, that their job is to make others have good experiences and feel good.
And it's almost selfish, too.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So duration's number one.
Mm-hmm. Then second, intensity. Letting it grow inside your mind, giving yourself over to it, letting it fill you.
Okay.
Third factor, multimodality.
Now, that's the one that when you hear it, it's like, what does that mean? And what you're saying is wherever that experience shows up, if it could be a pleasant physical experience, it could be a pleasant mental experience, but wherever it shows up, experience it in other parts of you. And those other parts are, well, the parts are, you got mental, you got emotional, you got physical, you got anything else there?
Oh, sure. A handy way to subdivide experience and to appreciate that now you've got lots of opportunities to take in good things is to think of experience as having, you know, five components, potentially. One is thought, not just verbal thought, by the way, but also nonverbal thought, in which I include imagery and memory.
Mm-hmm.
And then second, perceptions, in other words, seeing sights, hearing sounds, and in particular, having body sensations or states in the body, like either relaxation or energization, you know, activation, vitality. Okay. Third aspect of experience is emotion, both transient feelings and enduring moods. Fourth aspect of experience are wants or desires, wishes, intentions, inclinations, values, and so forth. That's a very important kind of thing to let sink in, such as a commitment to one's sobriety or the intention to speak from the heart in an important relationship. You can let that sink in. And you can also, really register actions. That's the fifth component of experience. So any one of these come under the heading of multimodality. And in particular for people, I encourage them to try to help the thought track become also a sensation and emotion track. So the experience becomes as textured and rich as possible. It's interesting, just a quick personal comment here, Terrence. You know, I'm an intellectual guy. I love, you know, thought and science and all the rest of that. My whole journey into neuroscience in some depth has brought me back into the body, back into a felt intimacy with receiving a delicious, ordinary experience and having a felt sense of kindness toward yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a sense that you matter enough to really, really, really let it sink in. So anyway, that's multimodality.
Okay, and I think it's really important for people to get that absorbing it by duration is one thing, but the other is to bring it to these other parts of you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's exactly right. The richer the experience is, the more sensual it is, the more it's going to turn into neural structure. It's what any school teacher knows, right? Get the kids moving.
Yep.
You know, engage the whole body.
Yep.
Have them be kind of excited about what they're learning. Have them, you know, have an emotional component too. Give them ways to relate to what they're learning so it really sinks in.
Okay, we've got about a minute and a half. I'm going to read one little quote here, and then I'll let you give your final thought. When a Native American elder was asked how she had become so wise, so happy, and so respected, she answered, "In my heart there are two wolves, a wolf of love and a wolf of hate. It all depends on which one I feed each day." To me, that's a very wise way of shorthandedly talking about what we're talking about. Your closing thought, Rick Hansen.
Oh, absolutely. We're always feeding one wolf or another, and as I say in Tibet, if you take care of the minutes, the years will take care of themselves. And that's the opportunity we have. The most important minute of our life is always the next one, because that's where we have influence. And if I could close with a quote from the Buddha, he says, "Think not lightly of good, saying, it will not come to me. Drop by drop is the water pot filled. Likewise, the wise one, gathering it little by little, fills oneself with good."
Very good. So again, the new book is Hardwiring Happiness, the New Brain Science of Contentment, Calm, and Confidence. And what is different about this book, if that wasn't made clear, is that this one is really in some ways a workbook, a handbook. It's about taking what Rick has learned and gathered and making it practices that you can use in your own life. And you can learn more about all of this at rickhanson.net, RickHanson.net. I think mindfulness is a pretty good gift for us to give ourselves this holiday season, good for stress reduction, creativity, clarity, energy, sleep, health. Try this over the holidays, the rest of the holidays here. Disconnect from the chatter, the pace, the noise, disengage from the habits, the patterns, the ruts. It's basically free, sustainable, renewable, and efficient. It involves taking action where you know you can make a difference in your own brain. It's taking back control. It's investing in yourself. It's adding or refreshing a practice that has no age limit. For this week's conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net. Or a world that just might work.com to the same website if you want to receive my email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and a few articles of background on those issues. Sign up at my site or email me at TEMCNALLY@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum Podcast on iTunes. This program is also going to be archived for the next 90 days at kpfk.org. Check audio archives and scroll down by date and time. Thanks to G, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week. Thank you, Rick Hansen, and keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you, Terrence. A pleasure.
What's your emergency?
America's healthcare system is broken, and people are dying.
Welcome to Code WAC, where we shine a light on our callous healthcare system, how it hurts us, and what we can do about it. I'm your host, Brenda Gazar. This time on Code WAC, is California due for a different kind of big one? Will single-payer rock the healthcare industry? We recently spoke to Michael Leidy, president of the pro-single-payer coalition Healthy California Now and former healthcare constituency director for Bernie 2020. Welcome to Code WAC, Michael.
There's so much going on with healthcare in California. There's a bill to establish a California single-payer system, a constitutional amendment proposing funding for it, some key legislative hearings in the works, and a floor vote on the bill by the state assembly by the end of January. It sounds like it might be go time for California single payer. Let's start with the bill AB 1400, known as CalCare.
Well, AB 1400, of course, would establish a single payer system in California that would combine federal monies into a state-funded trust fund that would provide comprehensive guaranteed health care to all residents of California. It would eliminate co-pays, premiums, and deductibles, save California workers and businesses literally billions of dollars, save the state overall probably over 10 years as much as $486 billion. So it's a huge cost savings. It's a huge advantage in terms of quality of care and the ability to actually get the care that Californians need and deserve.
Get the full Code WAC story on ProgressiveVoices.com and on the PV app. Catch all our episodes by subscribing to Code WAC wherever you find your podcasts. This podcast is powered by Heal California, a nonprofit that uplifts the voices of those fighting for healthcare reform around the country. Until next time, stay healthy.